Welcome back, everybody.
Hey, guys.
This is Beth.
And this is Diz.
And this is
Trigger Warning.
And we have part two about Union Carbide this
time.
Dun,
dun.
Yeah. And it just gets worse and worse after last week. A few days ago. So trigger warnings for today's episode include death, a lot of it, including death of children, death of elderly people, kind of all ages in between, death of animals, and basically disaster, and some more death.
Yeah.
Oh, and racism.
Yeah, that's true.
Yes.
Yeah.
And corporate greed.
Yes, the corporate greed guy.
Greediness. So, I'm going to jump right into things here. If you remember from our first part on this, Union Carbide was formed in 1917 when it merged with a few other companies that had overlapping products. Carbide, as it was usually called, was famous or infamous for its innovation and the wide variety of products they produced and distributed. They sold the hell out of asbestos in the 60s and 70s. With their product Calidria being one of the most used asbestos brands in the country.
That sounds like a really bad medical thing.
Calidria. It's like chlamydia.
Yeah.
It's too close. Yeah.
Okay, proceed.
They created the first antifreeze in 1927, and it was sold under Eveready Prestone antifreeze.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
They also created the first batteries for portable radios sold under the brand name Eveready, which came out in 1959.
Wow.
Yeah. So, along with other locations around the country and beyond, Carbide also has a chemical plant in Institute, West Virginia.
That's the name.
Mm-hmm. And the plant sits alongside the Kanawha River.
Mm-hmm.
And if that sounds familiar to you, it's because I couldn't pronounce it last time, and I probably still can't, and that's fine.
Oh, like, did you Google it?
No, but that's where the Hawk's Nest Tunnel and Dam were built,
mm-hmm.
which I told you about in part one.
And guys, if you haven't already, go listen to part one first.
Yeah.
You got to get that information.
There's a lot more to build up. Yeah.
So do that first.
There's a whole lot more disaster where this came from.
Yes.
So, on the morning of August 12th, 1985, residents of Institute were alarmed when the smell of a chemical wafted from the plant toward their homes.
Oh.
Union Carbide had closed the plant the previous December to update their safety systems. And 5 months and $5 million later, they reopened it, reassuring the residents and workers that the plant was very safe and leaks wouldn't be something they would have to worry about. If there was a leak somehow, then the computerized system would alert the workers, informing them of the speed and direction the leak was headed in.
That's fancy.
I know. The workers, in turn, would sound a siren and alert emergency officials so they could evacuate residents or reassure them depending on what the problem was.
Mm-hmm.
But the town residents claimed to have smelled the chemical odor at least 15 minutes before any warnings sounded. According to the residents, the chemical was already burning their eyes, throats, and lungs before the warning told them to tune into the television and radio for instructions. A total of 135 people sought medical help. 28 people were hospitalized for injuries related to the leak.
Oh, my.
But the residents of Institute were lucky. The chemical that leaked from Union Carbide plant was originally identified as aldecarb oxime.
You got some words, girl.
I know. Later, they amended the identification, stating that it was a small group of chemicals that were released. Along with the aldecarb oxime, or however it's supposed to be pronounced, there were dichloromethane, which is a solvent used to contain the oxime, whatever, carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide, and some sulfur compounds.
Sulfur.
Yeah, and so the sulfur compounds were what caused the odor that the residents could smell.
Okay.
Because it smells like rotten eggs.
Yeah.
According to company reps, the leak began around 9:35 a.m. and lasted for about 15 minutes. But people playing golf and tennis nearby claimed to have seen a plume of gas rising from the plant around 9:15 a.m.
Oh.
So residents experienced some deja vu that evening when they started smelling the smell again. A dozen 911 calls were placed between 9:30 and 10 p.m. because people were concerned that there was a new leak. But according to the reps at Union Carbide, no new leak was discovered. The new smell was actually from, like, lingering leftover effects where the air got colder and condensed to the ground. So the airborne particles were still in the air in the area.
And it got colder.
And as it got cooler in the evening time, I mean, this is August in West Virginia. I don't think it gets too cold.
It wouldn't get very cold. Well, maybe in the mountains or something. Yeah,
but it condensed and it
okay.
It came down to the ground. So that's why they could smell it again, because it dropped. So the original leak was said to have resulted from a gasket on a storage tank that failed because of increasing pressure. But I could not find anything that explained what caused the increased pressure.
Interesting.
Yeah. So the gasket failed because there's pressure.
But we don't know why there was.
Like, okay, that makes sense. What caused the extra pressure? I don't know. I couldn't find anything about it. So as I mentioned in the first episode, the issue of race still plays a role in corporate indifference when it comes to people that live near chemical plants. This includes plants belonging to Union Carbide, now owned by Dow Chemical, by the way. They were purchased by Dow Chemical in 2001.
Wow.
And those owned by other companies. Institute West Virginia is actually a classic example of what's become known as a, quote, sacrifice zone for pollution. Communities that are closer to industrial or chemical plants are usually lower income and composed of minorities.
Hmm.
This happens over time due to a variety of practices, which include redlining and land use and zoning decisions. And the practices are made by elected officials, government regulators, and corporate executives, all of whom live outside these sacrifice zones.
Of course.
So due to their low income status, these communities also lack access to other resources like healthcare and education.
Uh-huh.
The majority Black community of Institute is one of two such communities in West Virginia and has a higher than normal cancer rate. There has been a decades-long fight to raise awareness and fight for legislation that will reduce air and water pollution from the carbide plant, but unfortunately, their outcry has fallen mostly on deaf ears. Like I said, Institute is representative of Black communities throughout the U.S. ProPublica did some research and a study, and based on emissions data over a five-year period, the mostly Black or minority areas have a disproportionate risk from industrial pollution. According to them, on average, the cancer risk from air pollution in these places is more than double that of majority white neighborhoods.
Oh, wow.
Due to their proximity to the plants, the residents of these poor communities breathe dirtier air than people that live in wealthier communities further away from the plants. So again, Union Carbide or Dow plant isn't the only one, but it is one of the worst, according to ProPublica. Their analysis looked at 7,600 facilities across the U.S. that increased cancer risks in their surrounding communities. So these are plants that people nearby have increased cancer risks. Out of the 7,600 of them, the Dow / Union Carbide plant ranked 17th.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Let that sink in for a second.
Yeah. So 17th out of 7,600, that is not one that you want to be a leader of.
You do not want to lead that pack.
No. The area within and around the plant fence line has a cancer risk from industrial air pollution of 1 in 280.
Ew.
Which is 36 times the level the EPA considers acceptable.
Wow.
In 2020, West Virginia State Health Department investigation found that communities living downwind of the chemical plants in Institute and South Charleston, West Virginia, are experiencing a spike in ethylene oxide-related cancers, but they cautioned that the findings were, quote, not conclusive. Sure, Jan. Okay.
Okay, then.
Yeah. So the people who lived in and around Institute, West Virginia in August of 1985 were right to be concerned when they smelled gas that morning. It had only been about 8.5 months since Union Carbide's sister plant in Bhopal, India, had been the site of the worst industrial accident in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So, In the 1980s, one of the most used pesticides in the world was called 7. So, said like the number, but spelled S-E-V-I-N. It was very deadly to pests, but it was extremely toxic to mammals as well, including humans. One of the reasons for this is an ingredient called methyl isocyanate, or MIC. Inhaling, ingesting, and touching MIC can be toxic, even in quantities as low as 0.4 parts per million.
Oh my gosh.
And it has no antidote. Exposure can cause coughing, chest pain, difficulty or painful breathing, asthma, irritation of the eyes, nose, and throat, and damage to the skin. If exposed to higher levels of MIC, over 21 parts per million, the resulting symptoms can include pulmonary edema, which is like basically fluid in your lungs, emphysema and hemorrhages, bronchial pneumonia, and death.
That's horrible.
Yeah. MIC is not usually detectable by smell, but at between like 2 to 4 parts per million, the tear ducts can be affected. So that's what usually warns people that the chemical's there. One source said that, another source said that at 5 parts per million that you could smell it, so I don't know which is correct. But I would think around that time your ears and nose are getting are starting to get irritated anyway, so I don't know how well you can smell it. At 21 parts per million, MIC in the air is considered intolerable to humans, and it works on the same receptors as tear gas.
Ew.
So if MIC is kept under 102 degrees Fahrenheit or 39 degrees Celsius, it is a colorless liquid with a pungent odor that is extremely flammable. Union Carbide India Limited, UCIL, was a chemical company founded in 1934. 50.9% of UCIL was owned by Union Carbide and Carbon Corporation, which is what it was called then. 49.1% was owned by Indian investors, including the government of India and government-controlled banks. So, Carbide owned just a little over 50%, and then India owned just slightly under 50%. So, UCIL operated a plant in Bhopal, located in Madhya Pradesh in central India. The plant produced several chemicals, including a commonly used pesticide called 7. 7 was made starting with a base chemical called carbaryl. The carbaryl was reacted with MIC and alpha naphthol to make the pesticide 7. So on December 3rd, 1984, at 12:05 a.m., workers detected a minor gas leak at the Union Carbide factory. A worker named Suman Day, was a control room operator, was the first point of contact. So they contacted him. He left the control room to go check it out. So he searched for the leak and went to the storage area where the volatile chemicals were kept under concrete. It was like thick layers
like
of
a
concrete
bunker.
Where the storage tanks were kept. So MIC was kept there along with another chemical, which was phosgene, which was used in chemical warfare during World War I.
Oh my gosh. These are not
your average everyday, like, you know, just
chemicals.
Normal chemicals.
Basic chemicals.
Yeah, just basic chemicals. So he smelled gas, so he knew that the leak was close by, and he found it, but it was leaking very slowly. So minor leaks there were not unusual. So he checks all the pressure and temperature gauges, and he's like, okay, everything looks normal, so we won't worry about it right now. Because they've gotten so used to small leaks and the choking effects of the chemicals that they weren't freaked out by this.
That's in itself terrifying.
Yeah, exactly. But inaccurate meter readings were also common in the 15-year-old plant. So when the workers called again, he decided to recheck the readings. It's now 12:20 a.m. roughly, so about 15 minutes later, and the gauges are now off the scale. The pressure in the storage tanks is dangerously
15
high.
15 minutes later?
Yes.
Whoa.
So Suman Day rushes back to the storage area, The area is now hot, like the actual ambient temperature is hot, and the concrete is vibrating and trembling beneath his feet.
That would be so
Yes.
scary.
He can hear a hissing sound like, quote, a steam engine. So he rushes back to the control room. Around 12:30 a.m., he attempts to turn on the emergency safety systems to stop the release of gas. The first of these safety systems is the bent gas scrubber. And according to what I found online, scrubbers work by forcing a contaminated gas stream through a scrubbing solution. The solution chemically reacts with the targeted pollutants, which absorbs or neutralizes them.
Okay,
So, in not
chemical,
fancy
that's
speak,
pretty cool.
basically, it has a chemical in it that reacts in some kind of chemical reaction
Yeah,
that makes
neutralizes
the
it.
bad chemical not bad no more.
Okay, got you.
So,
Oh my gosh.
the clean gas is then released into the atmosphere, and the used scrubbing solution with the pollutant or chemical product in it is treated or disposed of responsibly. Anyway,
In allegedly
allegedly
responsibly.
responsibly. Unfortunately, in Bhopal that night, the scrubber wasn't working. So the next safety system was the flare tower, which sounds exactly like it is. Basically, it's there to burn off the gas before it can escape the area. But this doesn't work either. With these two systems down, the highly pressurized gas escapes through the pipes and into the atmosphere. So gaseous MIC is 1.4 times heavier than normal air.
Okay.
So as soon as it hurtles out of this venting chimney and begins to disperse, it also begins to sink. So Sumande announces the leak and orders an evacuation of the plant and triggers the alarm. Unfortunately, the plant is located near a residential slum in Bhopal, and the wind happens to be blowing the cloud of this gas directly at the people that are innocently sleeping in their makeshift housing and shacks. I mean, it's just rows
Literal
of like
shacks.
housing and whatever they can make it out of.
Wow.
So obviously not airtight and that kind
Yeah.
of thing. And these are poor people. This is a slum. They're poor people. So a plant worker who had the night off, T.R. Chuhan, wakes up because the son was crying, and he and his family are very quickly having trouble with irritation of the eyes and everything. So he goes outside to check things out, and he realizes immediately what's happening. He rushes his family down the street where he spots a driver in an otherwise empty car. And I'm sure in that area, cars were not common.
Prevalent,
People probably didn't have them a lot.
yeah.
So he convinces the driver to get them out of the city by explaining that if the man wants to live, he has to leave. And he takes them with him. And they are not the only ones trying to get away. The quiet, empty streets, 12:30 in the morning, fill up quickly with people coughing, choking, vomiting. They're all terrified, they're confused, gasping for breath and running, and many of them are falling dead in the streets. Meanwhile, the workers at the plant have tried their last option for stopping the gas. They've tried spraying the plume of gas with water from emergency water hoses, but the hoses are too short and not powerful enough to reach the top of the venting chimney. So at this point, they are helpless to stop this. The local hospital is inundated with patients. They've been told by the police that the chemical is ammonia, but the symptoms are too severe for that. Their normal treatments are not working. One of the doctors gets on the phone and begins searching for answers. He's told it's not ammonia, it's phosgene, which would be bad. But then finally, he's told, no, it's MIC. They've never heard of MIC, so
The
they have no.
doctors had never heard of it.
Most of the medics and stuff there had not heard of it. So they had no antidote, nor any knowledge of how to treat the patient's symptoms.
Oh my
And they had
goodness.
no help from Union Carbide. So by 3 a.m., the line of people outside the hospital was a line of dead bodies. By daylight, there were at least 3,000 people dead in their beds, in the streets, and in the hospitals. Children and the elderly were hit hardest since they were often trapped close to the ground where the cloud of poisonous gas was most dense. Along with human casualties, animal carcasses lined the roads, cows, anything like that. Basically, any living creature in a 40-kilometer square area that couldn't get away was dead. So, as with any disaster, the question of how the tragedy happened started immediately.
Mm-hmm.
Not just in Bhopal, but across the world, the incident was in the headlines. This was a facility run by a huge corporation that had multi-million dollar safety systems in place. So how could something on this scale occur? The government of India sent investigators in the day after the leak. Warren Anderson, the Union Carbide CEO, flew in around this time to assess the situation. He was arrested, as he was ultimately the person responsible for Carbide and all of its facilities.
Oh, he got arrested!
Many people believe his arrest was just for show.
Oh.
When he was arrested at the airport, he was taken to the Union Carbide guest house rather than a jail cell.
It was just for show then.
Yeah.
Come on, people.
He was released on bail a few hours later and went back to the U.S. So this left India's government investigators to look into the gas leak and its cause. But the investigation couldn't start right away. The leak had begun with storage tank E610. E610 had been 75% full, which is way over the company regulation of 50% full. The entire contents, 42 tons of MIC, had evaporated and escaped. But what stalled the investigation right away was the investors finding out that this could be worse, because there was another 30 to 35 tons of MIC in storage tank E611. So the remaining MIC seemed stable at that point, but so had E610 until right before it wasn't. It was like small leak. 15 minutes later, it's a big leak and everything's going haywire. So they know that they have to get rid of it, but there's only one safe way, safe, quote unquote, way to do that. They have to restart the factory, not knowing exactly what caused the leak, and use up the MIC that's stored there, and basically produce a bunch of the pesticide 7 so that the MIC can be used up so that they can then investigate what caused the problem.
Oh my.
Because if it happens again, yeah, then it's bad. So, difficult decision to make because, like I said, they don't know what actually caused it. So, if they restart the factory, just restarting it could cause problems. It.
Yeah.
There's obviously people, trauma. People are literally dying. So, 13 days after the disaster, 13 days, thousands are still dying. And tens of thousands are still hospitalized. But restarting production is the only way that they can guarantee that the remaining MIC can be fully removed. That is, if it doesn't leak when they restart the factory. So, since they aren't sure what caused the original leak, they call their plan Operation Faith. The chemists and investigators had said, basically, have faith in us. We're going to have faith in the fact that we know what we're doing. So, Operation Faith, we're going to restart the factory and know that we know what we're doing well enough to make sure that this doesn't happen again, so we can get rid of this and whatever. But they were also prepared in case the worst happened. So, when the factory was about to be restarted, they had a helicopter flying over, ready to dump water on the plant.
Okay, that's fantastic.
The entire plant was also encircled with wet canvas to stop the flow of gas if there was another leak. Because, again, it would go up, and then it would start coming down because it's heavier, and then it would hit that canvas, and the water in the canvas and the water from the helicopter would dilute it, basically.
Yeah, okay.
Dissolve it.
Okay, got it.
So they were prepared. But most of the people of Bhopal were like, nope, I'm out. It emptied out basically as soon as production began on December 16th. The only people who stayed behind were the ones that were too sick to leave the hospital. But even hospitalized people, if they could travel, if they could move on their own, they left.
So, and like the doctors and nurses and everyone even left those people?
I guess some of them probably had to stay because they had patients there. But yeah, but everybody else that could left. So they turned on the factory. Again, this is 13 days after the disaster, and it took 7 days to turn the rest of the MIC into 7 pesticide. But no leaks and no other incidents took place.
Now, I mean, thank goodness that it didn't. Yeah. Nothing else happened like that.
Exactly. That had to be, like, terrifying.
That would be terrifying.
I probably would have been like, yeah, I'm out. I'm out, yeah. Too. Mm-hmm. So now it was time to figure out what happened. The investigators dug up storage tank E610. Despite the concrete it was housed in, which was like feet thick, like okay. 1-2 feet thick concrete.
Okay.
Being cracked. The concrete was cracked. The tank itself was still in one piece. The emergency release valve, though, had ruptured. So, the team determined that 500 kilograms of water had entered the storage tank. When MIC makes contact with water, it heats up, boils, and vaporizes.
Chemistry.
Yes. I didn't realize, like, it's going to have to know chemistry to do a podcast. I know. So, when metal impurities are also involved, it makes the reaction even more violent.
Oh, my gosh.
In this case, they believe that iron from the rust inside the pipes exacerbated the situation, and this caused a runaway reaction that built up too much pressure and blew the emergency release valve apart, and that's what allowed the gas to escape. So, back in the U.S., Carbide CEO Warren Anderson announced that he believed that the gas leak had not been an accident but a deliberate act of sabotage.
Oh, my goodness.
The Steelworkers Union, which represented trade workers, apparently Steelworkers Union didn't just represent steelworkers at that point. They represented a lot of different trades. So the trade workers that were members of the Steelworkers Union decided to hire their own investigator. His name was Michael Wright, to look into the claim made by Warren Anderson. Because, of course, if sabotage happened, it was probably an employee. So this would make them look bad. So Michael Wright's expertise is in the safe operation of large factories. So he's done this thing for years.
Okay.
And I was watching a YouTube video with interviews with him and everything. And this man has such a calm demeanor. He really does. I'm like, he's the perfect person to investigate. Because he seems like the type to just sit and really listen to somebody. And then just sit and very plainly explain what happened. Yeah. So, unfortunately, Indian authorities denied his work visa, so he had to travel to Bhopal as a tourist. He told, Seconds to Disaster is where I
watched that.
It. Yes. Seconds to Disaster episode is where I watched it. So he said, quote, neither Union Carbide nor the Indian government really wanted us there. They didn't want somebody independent mucking around in their investigation. He gets there as a tourist. He cannot enter the carbide plant. So he and his team take long-range photographs of the equipment inside the plant and get a copy of the technical operating manual for the plant. They also interview the workers that were on duty the night of the accident. Wright studied the schematics of the factory to try to determine where the water came from that the Indian investigators determined triggered the reaction.
Uh-huh.
So at that point, they knew water somehow got in the tank. That's what caused the runaway reaction.
Okay. But so, we don't know where the water came from.
Right. So this is what he's trying to find out, because somebody could have introduced the water to the tank somehow.
Yeah. Okay. Okay.
He studied the schematics of the factory, trying to figure out where the water came from. He said that he was suspicious when he saw a chemical processing unit that sat near the MIC storage tanks. The processing unit would sometimes clog, and the workers would have to hook up a water hose to blow water through the system to unclog it. And this was not a dangerous operation. That was fine. Factory workers, though, told him that the company had installed a pipe that created a shortcut allowing them to use equipment interchangeably. Unfortunately, this actually created a permanent connection between the MIC storage tanks and the rest of the plant. This jumper line basically provided a direct route through which water could reach the storage tanks. And on the night of December 2nd, the accident happened a little after midnight on December 3rd.
Mm-hmm.
So at 9:30 on December 2nd, water had been pumped in to flush out the pipes. And I think in the episode they said that the workers had noticed that it wasn't coming out the other end. And then finally it did, and they're like, okay, I guess it's fine. But apparently it's because part of it was diverted into the MIC tanks. Yeah. There was still an item that, had it been in place, could have prevented the water from reaching the MIC and the storage tanks. A metal plate called a slip blind, which also had like five other names, that it basically slides in between two sections of pipe, creating a watertight seal.
Wow, just a piece of...
A piece of metal.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And they're commonly used when flushing out pipes because it can cut off paths to equipment you don't want it to go to, and that kind of thing. But there was no slip line in place to prevent water from continuing on its way to the storage tank. Beyond the metal plate, the slip line, there's also one last barrier that would prevent water from getting into the storage tanks. With the tank at about half full, inert nitrogen gas is pumped into the tank. Because MIC is in liquid form.
Right.
So the nitrogen gas is pumped in, and it creates a high-pressure layer between the liquid MIC and any water that might try to flow in.
Chemistry.
Yeah.
That's pretty
chemistry,
cool.
I know. So the nitrogen, there's too much pressure going out in every direction that if water comes to the edge, it can't get past the nitrogen. Because
that is
the nitrogen is pushing it back.
That is so cool.
Chemistry. So cool. Yeah. Michael Wright said he'd seen this system work before. It's usually safe. It's effective. But the plant worker, Chuhan, that I mentioned earlier, told Seconds to Disaster that he had seen workers trying to pressurize E610 back on November 30th. And faulty readings weren't unusual, but they couldn't get it to pressurize at all. And according to Chuhan, that could only mean that there was a leak in the line. He checked the log, and he said that it showed for 20 days it had not been holding pressure. So the nitrogen gas, there was apparently a leak somewhere there, that the nitrogen gas, they couldn't pump it in and get that high pressure that it needed. The faulty valve, the emergency release valve that was blown apart,
yeah,
could have been what was allowing the nitrogen to leak out. And, of course, with the nitrogen leaking out, then the water can leak in.
So many things have to be perfectly
right
in line for that to happen.
Now they know how water got into the tank, but it still doesn't mean it was an accident.
Right.
Or that it was done on purpose. If somebody had pumped water into the tank, they may not have anticipated the rust that was in there, which actually made the reaction worse.
Because it's like metal.
Right.
Or whatever.
It's metal impurities.
Yeah.
So they may, somebody could have put water in thinking that they were going to cause a big stink, but not realizing that it was going to kill these people, It could have also just been an accident from the pipes being flushed. Missing slip bind, faulty valve, nitrogen not being pressurized, basically just a cacophony of events, Wright continues with the investigation, trying to figure out why the emergency safety systems didn't operate that night.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing he looks into is the chemical scrubber. And he's surprised when the plant workers tell him that they didn't see any instrumentation that showed that the scrubber was operating at all. The scrubber would not have been able to neutralize all of the MIC that was released that night, but it would have been kind of a start.
Yeah.
So, he turns his attention to the flare tower.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out with that, about 2 months prior, the workers had removed a 4-foot section of the corroded pipe from the flare tower and had never ended up replacing it. And according to Wright, if the flare tower had been functioning that night, it would have completely eliminated all of the MIC gas.
I'm just over here shaking my head, you guys.
Silence from Diz is just her shaking her head.
I just don't have the words.
Yeah. There was still that one last thing was The hoses. Hoses are installed around the emergency vent chimney, and workers are trained to spray water at the venting gas to dissolve it. But as I said before, the system was undersized, and it couldn't reach the height of the release vent. So water started the disaster, and water could have stopped the disaster, but it didn't.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Overall, Michael Wright found that the Bhopal plant was losing money. They had expanded several years before, overestimated the demand for 7, and they had been chopping away at their budget ever since to try to make up for it. Unfortunately, the cost-cutting was all at the expense of safety. In fact, there had been 5 chemical accidents at the plant between 1981 and 1984.
Oh my gosh!
There was a leak in December 1981 that injured 2 workers and killed a 3rd. Maintenance had also laughed at the facility. A maintenance supervisor had been laid off that normally would have been responsible for making sure the slip lines were in place and the gauges were were working well or whatever. All the gauges, they don't know how the readings were that night necessarily because it was cheaper just not to do the maintenance on the gauges. They don't know what the pressure really was when Sumande went and checked it, and it showed that it was still like, all the pressure readings were normal, and then 15 minutes later, they were off the charts. They don't know. There's no way to know for sure what that was, because the gauges weren't all calibrated.
It's like, why would he even go then? Why didn't he just stay up there with everyone else?
Well, and he may not have realized that they were that far off, but they didn't have a maintenance supervisor. They had no maintenance schedule, probably.
And no money at that for point. It anyway.
Yeah. Michael Wright determined that Warren Anderson's theory that sabotage caused the disaster was just a smokescreen. He said that it was intended to cover up the company's greed, since they knew that their cost-cutting was impacting the safety of their employees and the surrounding community.
Yeah.
CEO of Union Carbide, Warren Anderson, was declared a fugitive from justice by the Chief Judicial Magistrate of Bhopal on February 1st, 1992. For failing to appear at court hearings in a culpable homicide case. In 2003, a formal extradition request was issued. The United States declined to extradite him, citing a lack of evidence, and the Chief Judicial Magistrate of Bhopal issued an arrest warrant for Anderson on July 31st, 2009.
What the heck?
This happened in 1984. In August of 2009, a Carbide spokesperson said Union Carbide had no role in operating the plant at the time of the accident, as the factory was owned, managed, and operated by employees of Union Carbide India Limited, even though technically Union Carbide itself had just over 50% ownership. 8 former senior employees of UCIL were found guilty on June 7th, 2010. So Indian executives
were held responsible.
After they were convicted, a Carbide spokesperson said, quote, all the appropriate people from UCIL, officers, and those who actually ran the plant on a daily basis have appeared to face charges. And then Warren Anderson died on September 29, 2014, at the age of 92. In 1989... Union Carbide agreed to pay a settlement of $470 million to the Indian government to disperse to the victims of the disaster.
Yeah, right.
In 2010, the Indian government filed a petition asking for an additional $1.1 billion, saying that the original settlement was based on an incorrect victim count. The Supreme Court of India denied the petition in 2023. Many of the victims are still awaiting compensation. Since there are so many still feeling the effects today. Between the gas leak in 1984 and the decades of groundwater pollution from the abandoned factory, it's difficult to find someone living in Bhopal that does not face some kind of medical condition or crisis. Today, a little over 40 years since the disaster, survivors and their children face a myriad of health problems. These include increased risk of kidney disease, oral throat, and lung cancer, respiratory disease, vision problems, miscarriages, irregular periods, early menopause, cerebral palsy, and cognitive impairments. Some people believe that Bhopali residents assume that many conditions are related to the gas leak or subsequent pollution, but they're really normal problems that many people have, like high blood pressure or diabetes. So a lot of the residents go to see a doctor, and the doctor's just like, this is not because of the gas leak. You just have diabetes because you have diabetes, or whatever it is. So whether their rates are higher or higher than normal or not, though, disaster remains as the worst industrial accident in history. These are the numbers. Over 500,000 people were exposed to the MIC gas. Around 3,000 people died in the first few hours of the leak. Approximately 10,000 people died within the first 3 days. And around 22,000 people have subsequently died over the years as a direct result of their exposure on December 3rd, 1984, or because of the groundwater contamination from the abandoned factory.
I didn't even think about the groundwater.
Yeah. Because the factory basically was abandoned after they finished their investigation. 22,000 plus 10,000 plus 3,000.
Well, like the workers that were working that night, did any of them die
Oh, I'm sure they did.
from like
In the Seconds from Disaster episode, they actually interviewed Sumande and like one of the doctors and the chemist, one of the chemists that went in for the investigation, and Michael Wright that did the outside
Yeah.
investigation. And Sumande had said that he, after he sounded the alarm and stuff, he put on a mask and stuff and went into the factory to try to get out the workers, but within like no time he was out of air and had to leave. Like he couldn't stay in there. But anybody that was in there that was exposed,
They died for
yeah.
sure.
And the doctor, I think one of the doctors had said something about the people that were running away, it probably impacted them faster
Because they were
because they basically like drowned in their own secretions, their own lungs,
shut your dang
because it just
mouth.
filled with fluid.
That is heartbreaking.
Yeah. So there are pictures of bodies just wrapped in white sheets and stuff, just laying along the road. There's videos of dead cows and buffalo or whatever being lifted up by forklifts and stuff to move them out of the road.
And it's from negligence and apathy
And greed.
and greed.
Yeah. Because if they weren't producing this, or well, they had all the chemicals there to make seven, but there wasn't the demand. So those chemicals just sat there and they were losing money because they have all this money in the chemicals they have, but
But they're not ma
there's
putting
no
it back.
demand for the seven pesticide.
Right.
So you know that Union Carbide India Limited, since they're half owner, but just a little under half, that they were getting pressure from the corporation, the US side, the
Yeah.
50% owner, to do something about it.
Yeah, stop losing
Yeah.
money. Do
And you
something.
think about a factory like that surrounded by a very poor community, probably a lot of the people that like lived there worked at the factory. There were probably a lot of people there.
Well, like the guy that sent his
Chuhan, yeah.
yeah, sent his family with the guy in the car or whatever.
He was like, take us out of here. Yeah.
Well, like, because he was a worker
Yeah.
and lived
And happened to
nearby.
be off. Yeah. And yeah, they actually had said too that a lot of the skilled workers, like the people who originally started running the plant and everything, as the plant started cost cutting, they got rid of them because they could pay other unskilled workers less money. And so these,
So all
they
this.
didn't know what to do. The factory workers didn't know, and they probably didn't know the severity of the chemicals they had, and they didn't know. They were just
Yeah.
normal people just trying to live, and
They were
they,
just like, oh, great, I'll work for this company.
yeah, it's like it's a job,
Yeah.
And these people literally, the pictures, they were like just shacks, like tents, kind of like. Part of it looked like wood, like plywood panels. Part of it looked like maybe canvas material. Like it looked
Just
like they just put
literally
together
whatever.
whatever they had. Yeah. And it showed,
Like they had no chance.
yeah, one of the reporters was there, like, I guess it was, I'm assuming it was when they restarted the factory because everybody had left. And he said that usually that area was like, it was full, like 10,000 people lived in that slum, that area. And he said it's completely empty. And it was.
10,000 people.
Yeah. And I don't know how big the community is, but the MIC gas spread out over 40 square kilometers. And I'm not good with kilometers, but
I'm
like,
definitely not.
it's not that big of a location, but it's a big location,
Well,
you
and
know?
especially in India.
Yeah. These are people that their families are all living together. There's grandparents living with their kids, living with their children and great grandchildren, and, you know, the families were basically sleeping on the floor on dirt ground. And of course, the lower to the ground they were, the worse it was.
Oh, yeah, that's true. I
Because
keep forgetting that
it was basically like a poisonous
sinks.
fog,
Yeah.
is basically what it looked like. And it just spread across because there's nothing that can really stop that. Except for the safety systems that weren't working.
That weren't working.
And then, if you remember when I started this episode, I mentioned that in West Virginia, they had just closed that factory down for 5 months and done $5 million to update their safety
Yeah.
systems.
Yeah.
This is why. Because in Bhopal,
Because I didn't want that happening.
yeah. Because if it happened again, everybody knew it was their fault.
Yeah.
See, this way they could say, oh, that's because it was UCIL, it was India Limited that did that.
Yeah.
We don't do that here. We update our safety systems and make sure everything's running right, allegedly.
Allegedly.
And by the way, the people asking for money still that got denied, it's because Dow Chemical, that now owns Union Carbide's, like, hey, we didn't own them back then, so it's none of our business. It's no, we don't have anything to do with that. Sorry. Now, Dow Chemical is one of the biggest companies in the
In
world.
the world. I know because I listened to
The news growing up when they would say NASDAQ and
and
Dow.
Dow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember
Yeah.
that.
They
But
were
I
so big in the
also.
early 80s and 90s and stuff like that, that they specifically mentioned them when they talked about stocks and stuff. I had no idea what it meant.
Yeah, I was like,
It
I
was
don't know
a
what that is.
specific company.
Because it was that big.
Yeah.
I also have listened to not a podcast but a YouTube video from Bailey Sarian.
I've heard the name. Yeah.
She usually does murder mystery and makeup, but she also has a dark history, and she did Dow
Yeah.
for dark history. Go find it, guys, because it was very, very interesting.
Yeah.
Just FYI. And that's where I first heard about Dow,
Yeah.
the company itself, and the alleged whatever. I'll just say that.
The alleged.
Whatever.
Alleged whatever. Yeah. So, I guess technically Dow says they're not Union Carbide, so I'm just going to say Union Carbide sucks and they were full
Yeah.
of a bunch of greedy assholes.
And they
And
didn't care about anyone.
yeah, and that's why their asbestos killed people. That's why their tunnel project in West Virginia killed a bunch of people. It's like if you added up how many people that company has killed, either through negligence or just disregard for their health and lives or their products.
That would be very
Or
interesting number to
that
see.
would be probably a
Massive.
number that was so high it would be almost inconceivable.
Yeah.
That would be numbers like in a war.
Yeah.
Because you
That's
don't
a.
eat, and there's no way to know for sure how many people were killed, like from the asbestos we talked about
Right. Yeah.
and the tunnel where people left and stuff after the project was over, and silicosis. And like we said before, if you haven't listened to that episode, go back and listen to that one. But yeah, so we don't like them,
Yeah, that
allegedly.
first episode helps set up
All of
what
this.
they're like.
Yeah.
You already see it from in the 30s
Yeah.
and 40s
Yeah. Yeah,
is when it
exactly.
kind of
Yeah.
started.
Hawk's
And
Nest Tunnel was
it
1930,
totally,
1931.
you
Yeah.
see that reputation being built
Yeah.
and their, I'll say, values with air quotes.
And it almost gets worse each time.
Yeah.
And I think, like, I put the West Virginia one before Bhopal only because Bhopal was such it was the main story that's what I actually started researching was what happened in Bhopal. And I was just going to do one episode on Bhopal because that's what I had heard of. And then I started looking into Union Carbide and I saw the West Virginia leak and then I saw the asbestos stuff and then I saw the Hawk's Nest Tunnel and I'm like, no, this could be a two-part
That's
just on Union
huge.
Carbide and all the people that they have killed. And so I put West Virginia before Bhopal just to kind of show, like, yeah, they just did the safety systems and stuff, but like I said, you throw it back and it's like, oh, that's why. Because they just killed like tens of thousands of people.
So it wasn't just like, oh, we really just want to make sure our everything is up to date and safe for everyone. It's, oh shoot, we don't want this to happen here in the US.
And it, like, the leak would have been one thing, but also that factory's still killing people because of the chemical leaks and stuff. And the sacrifice zones around the chemical factories and stuff like that. And
That's just so
it's
mean
politicians
sounding.
and corporate, people, and they rezone things and then you change stuff around so that the low income housing is the one near the plants. And then the wealthier people are further away and they don't have to worry about it. Yeah, it's so frustrating. I was reading all through this and I just thought, I mean, there were families in all of these stories, families wiped out.
Whole families, yeah.
The only one in the West Virginia thing, the leak that happened after Bhopal, only 28 people were hospitalized, 135 people were, sought medical help. But that's because it was a less dangerous chemical. They put it like on a scale of like it'll make you nauseous and make your eyes water and like, it's uncomfortable, but it's not going to kill you. But it's like they had a leak. And like I said, I couldn't find out anything about what caused the increased pressure that caused the leak.
That's so
All I could find
suspicious.
on it was, oh, there was this leak at 9:30 in the morning, and some of the residents got upset and worried because this Bhopal thing happened in 1984, because it had only been like 8 months. And Bhopal, it was around the world, the headlines. Because it was such a huge, huge thing. And then when I came across it, I was like, I have never heard of this. I mean, 3,000 people in a few hours, 10,000 people in the first 3 days. Holy shit. And people literally laying in their beds, people literally running down the street, and they would just coughing and collapse, and they can't breathe and they die.
And then when they're going back to start it again so that they can start to investigate, get rid of the MIC, everyone's like, we are out. We are not.
And I don't blame them.
I don't blame them at all.
And it was like, it's good that it worked out, but they didn't know what caused it. And the people there were just like, no, because you think about entire families died and, people, could you imagine being like one person left out of all of your family?
No.
Like, why me? Why
The
was I the only
survivor
one that
guilt
survived?
would, yeah.
And then the ongoing health problems. And the doctors don't take you seriously.
And the company doesn't want to pay for your medical bills or anything.
And these people are already poor. Yeah, it's
They probably couldn't hardly even get medical assistance anyway.
yeah. Well, the amount of money that, like, in the first few days, they knew that around 3,000 people had died immediately. And they knew, like, within 3 days, like the 10,000-ish. The problem was is that the 22,000 that I mentioned that was over like a few years, when Union Carbide paid them that settlement of 4 point whatever, it was probably for like the 10,000 or so. But now we're looking at like triple that for the number of people. So the people that did get compensation, not all of them have ever gotten comp, some have never gotten compensation. But the ones that did get it probably didn't get much of anything.
That's nothing.
Yeah. Because that, I mean, it sounds like a lot of money, but like if their entire family was wiped out and their home, and they didn't have a lot, but it takes a lot to get started again when it's all
Yeah, when
gone.
you literally have
Yeah.
nothing.
And then their medical bills, like you said. And people end up with long-term medical conditions.
Yeah.
There was a story of a woman who was one of the main people that was kind of fighting for like the medical side of it, trying to get people like additional coverage and help from the Indian government for medical expenses for people who were affected by it. She was 3 or 5 or 6 or something, like really young when it happened. Because in 1984, I would have been roughly 5 years old.
Yeah.
So she was about that age, something like that. And her sister was on dialysis for kidney issues. Another sister had already died from kidney failure. Her son, I think it was born with cerebral palsy. And her mom had repeated lung infections throughout her life and ended up with pulmonary fibrosis. So her entire family is just like,
Messed up.
yeah, and fighting it every day. I mean, that stuff's not
Well,
comfortable.
it's terminal,
Yeah.
essentially.
Yeah. Dialysis, I'm sure, is not easy. That's something you have to go 2, 3 times a week, every week.
Yeah, forever.
Yeah. Or until you can get, new kidneys or
Right.
whatever. Like, how would somebody there get that if they don't have anything? They don't
They
have any
wouldn't.
money.
Exactly. They wouldn't.
Yeah. And freaking Warren Anderson died at 92 years old in Florida.
It's so
It
infuriating.
is. It's so.
It's so unbalanced. Like it's not fair,
Yeah.
and it's like it makes you pause at how unfair it really is.
Yeah.
And
It's hard to
it
put into
has
words.
been for years,
Right.
way before this
Yeah.
situation.
And it's unfortunate because you hear so much about these huge corporations that are like this.
Yeah.
There are stories out about certain online shopping entities that have Prime delivery. I won't name their name, but about them not letting employees go to the bathroom
Yeah.
and things like that. And allegedly. And so,
Because it's
like,
all down to the bottom line,
it is.
that
It's
money.
all about money.
Yeah. Most things come back to money.
It does. And it doesn't matter that the people are people.
Yeah, because they're not people to them
Yeah.
then.
I'm
What an
kind of
amazing story you have told us,
first
though.
two-parter, and it was holy crap.
Woo! Yeah, that was good.
It was good in a terrible way, but
Yeah, obviously, yeah.
so I'm kind of glad to be out of that.
I mean, I'm really happy because I really hated that you stopped it last time. I wanted to know,
Yeah.
but I too
It just
am.
kept building up, getting worse and worse every time I started a new story. It was
It
like,
really was.
now how many people died? Oh my gosh.
However, however,
Yeah.
however.
Anyway. All right. Well, I guess we will see you next time.
That's right, guys. Thanks
And
for tuning in.
yes, and I'm
We
sorry
appreciate
if
you.
I, it was a bummer. Diz, do you already know what our next one's gonna be?
Oh my goodness, it's a survival story.
Oh, good.
So
Okay.
that's
That
happy.
is happy. That's good.
There's
Okay, we need
sadness
that.
in it, but it's happy.
Everything has a little bit of sadness in it. It's
Yeah.
fine. All right. Well, we'll catch you then, and you guys be good or be good at it.
And watch for deer.